You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. Stu Goldsmith here with The Comedian's Comedian, the only podcast about comedy. Today I am talking to Rosie Jones, comedy's Thanos. And I say this because later on in the episode, as you'll hear, she, when she was a slip of a researcher, was listening to this podcast pre-comedian days, and she decided to herself that she would be on it. She is inevitable. Rosie is a revelation, and the starting point for this episode is about how, as soon as you meet her, you feel like you've known her forever, and she has this sort of archetypal quality. And we are going to get into lots and lots of detail about all sorts, but this is one of those ones, as her star is in the ascendance, some of you will know her, some of you may not. I highly recommend, if you have the opportunity now, just watch 5 minutes of her on the Apollo or something on YouTube. She is an absolute monster. And it is just a joy to spend time in her company. I was wandering around for the rest of the day, unable to chisel the grin off my face after this one. We're going to talk about how she leverages her comedy from people's constant underestimation of her. We're going to talk about the sort of the willpower and the sheer agency that she has on stage and how that constantly wrong-foots people. We'll talk about the precision comic timing that her cerebral palsy means she has to be incredibly precise about her timing. And we're going to get into some very nerdy detail on that. There's more of that on The Insiders. And we're going to talk about her new direction. And there's an absolute scoop here for something that I don't know if she was supposed to have mentioned, but I've Googled it and there's nothing on Google. So I think it's a huge story. Listen, enjoy yourselves. Go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders for 40 minutes. We couldn't stop talking. 40 minutes of extra content, including her genuinely unmissable insights on how to do well on a TV panel show, gleaned from her experience of loads of TV panel shows and also her prior life being a researcher and a production assistant behind the scenes. And we'll also talk about how she's changed her mind about whether or not people view her as an inspiration. And we'll discover why Nish Kumar is such a horrid man. All of that and more. 40 minutes of extras at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. But for now, this is Rosie Jones. Rosie Jones, welcome to The Comedian's Comedian. And here's where I'd like to start. I think you have a quality whereby I think I know you better than I do, which isn't to say I don't know you, but I know you a little bit. But you have this kind of fall in love with you quality whereby you meet people and it's like you've always been in their lives. Do you recognize that? Do you know what I mean? Is sort of, are there people in your life who are like that? So you know what quality I'm talking about. And do you feel you have that quality?
Yeah. And I think growing up, I would watch comedians. And my favourite comics were always the ones that I felt that I knew.
Yeah.
So I'm aware that I want to like portray this idea that everyone knows me. And they do, really. Like, I'm probably giving you 96% of me. But again, it's also my personality that I love people. I love talking. So on stage and off stage, friend, acquaintance or stranger, I will be so excited to see you and talk to you. So yeah, you say you know me. I think you bloody do.
Okay. Do you find then, because I try to, I don't try, I think I have a bit of that quality myself. What often really trips me up is that if I can't remember details about individuals, it sort of looks fake. Like, I think I tweeted something about this week, like, judge me not by whether or not you remember my name, but by my actions. Do you know what I mean? Because I run around projecting love, and I say to someone, and I've done this in the past, I don't know if you've done this, I've gone to someone, hey, how are you doing? What's your deal? What's your name? And they go, we've met 5 times. And I go, oh no, I'm a terrible, insubstantial piece of shit. Does that ever come up with you? Because is that like a risk when you are so outgoing and so embracing of the social?
No. Annoyingly, I got a great memory.
Okay.
Like, I know everyone. So last week I was at a pub with 2 friends. And a guy came over and I was like, hello, how have you been? How's your family? How's your kids? Did they do that award? Brilliant. Right, see you later. And he went and my friend said, oh, who was that? And I said, oh, he was my Uber driver 3 weeks ago. And it's like, yeah, like, I annoyingly remember the names of everyone, including all of my Uber drivers.
Amazing. That is such a... I've spoken to kind of power people like that before who are like, oh, that's one of the things. This guy, you know, whoever it is, someone who in royalty who just always seems to have like an index card in their head that's like, hey, Stu, how are your 2 children? Name. And you're like, oh, my God. Well, that's interesting because I think what that shows us is that I'm a fraud and you are genuinely interested in people. So do you think that quality, because when you're on stage, that quality definitely shines out of you. That's part of why you're likable. So to what extent, you sort of said 96% is like, it's 96% reality and 4% making an effort to do that because you know it's important.
Yeah, definitely. And it is like 96% of the time I do want to speak to Uber drivers. I do want to have a cup of coffee with a random woman who stops me in the street. And I do that. But then there's the 4% of the time when I want a quiet coffee or I want to put my headphones on and, and get into the stage now where people know me. And if I go into a cafe, people will go, "Oh, Rosie!" And they think they know me so much that they literally bring their coffee and they sit with me. And I'm like, that is so lovely. And I'm really glad I'm approachable. But sometimes a girl wants a quiet coffee and she wants everyone to fuck off.
That is interesting because you are sort of you're not on the cusp of anything, but you're clearly accelerating. Your career is very exciting at the moment, right? I first kind of heard of you when you were doing tour support for Nish. And I remember, and what we've got a listener question later on about why Nish Kumar is such a horrible ableist. But we'll get into that. But I remember at the time, I'd never heard of you, and Nish said, "Oh, I've got Rosie Jones opening for me." I said, "I don't know who that is." And I think all he said was, he just said, "Oh man, she's a beast." And I think that's like another element of your personality where instantly that's one of those things that as a kind of friend, a colleague, what have you, I can plug into. So I've been, you know, immediately I was like, "Oh, have you seen Rosie Jones?" And people are like, "Fucking Rosie Jones." I'm like, "Yeah, she's a beast, I hear." You know what I mean? Like joining in, do you know what I mean? So that, and I think that quality is tied to who you are on stage. You're kind of like a punk in a pinafore. Right? Do you know what I mean? When I first saw you, and less so now, I've noticed your last couple of TV appearances, they're a bit more grown up. But early, you looked kind of like Enid Blyton character. Do you know what I mean? And I just thought this is brilliant because it's a bait and switch, right? It's like I'm the Enid Blyton character who says prick and makes you call her daddy. And I'm like, oh my God, like no one's doing that. Do you know what I mean? So I'm sort of struggling to find a question in there sometimes, but I think there is something about the contrast between how much you just have this steamroller of likability where people are just like, you can't not fall in love with Rosie Jones, but you're not just using it to be nice. You're kind of using it to sort of, you're exploiting it to get, and I think that's part of what makes you a beast on stage at least is like, you know, you're murdering rooms because you constantly wrong-foot us. Discuss. I've got no question. But do you see where I'm coming from? Does that resonate?
Yes. Yes. And I'd be lying if I said I wasn't aware of that. And I think part of it is my personality. The whole, "Hello, I'm Rosie and I like everyone." And then part of it is my disability that I found that because of my cerebral palsy, people constantly underestimate me and I get called cute a lot and adorable, and that is where the dresses, dungarees, that childhood image comes from, because I want to step on stage and I want the audience to feel like they know who I am. They know I'm an adorable 5 foot little lady with a big disability. And then I am confident enough in these specifically written short jokes or the specifically positioned swear word that the audience goes, wait a minute, what the hell has happened? Because I thought I was in to watch a rag doll, but really I'm here to watch a disgusting sex robot.
Absolutely. And I think part of the kind of the reveal, and you are able to play the card, not that you're playing the same card over and over again, but almost like the fulcrum of the performance, is the fact that we don't expect you to have agency. And so the payoff every time is, obviously, I'm not what you expect. I'm sweary, and I'm sweary in a vicious and deliberate way. And I'm challenging, and I'm making you call me daddy. And suddenly I'm challenging sexually, and then I'm gay. And there's like, do you know what I mean? Like the amount of things where you're just continually upping the ante for look how much agency I've got. So I'm fascinated to hear that it is part of like a deliberate strategy with how you dress, because it's not just the clothes, it would also be how you have your hair. You do have a lovely sort of oval soft face that, you know, you've got quite a Tudor face. Do you know what I mean? I don't know anything about history, but you wouldn't look out of place. You've got one of those faces, you're like, oh, you're castable in kind of period drama, you know. So that kind of softness. So then with your more recent stuff where you are dressing in a bit more of a grown-up way, is that because you don't need to pull that move anymore?
Yeah, that's it. And I think I'm having an interesting change right now, and I don't fully have the answer, but I think that's what's exciting, in that as a comedian you always grow and change, but now I can't go on stage really. And I was gonna say act dumb, but more be that cute, adorable person, because now I get on stage and people often already expect me to be commanding and rude or challenging. So now I need less of the costume. I just need to go on and be like, hello, I'm Rosie, you know what the deal is, and now let's challenge you even further. And I don't know what that is yet, but definitely in my new stuff, I'm trying to be a bit more political about disability. So actually, that's the opposite way round, in that I come on stage and people go, oh, that's Rosie, she's a monster, she's a machine, a lover, no one can bring her down. And then I go, I am, and all disabled people are being fucked by the government. And then you got that reversal going, oh shit, like, even Rosie struggles with this government. So yeah, I'm now trying to go the other way of going, I'm alright, I'm a strong, independent, powerful, disabled woman, but we need to change how we treat disability.
Because presumably, from the perspective of, I'm just thinking back to that idea of you having agency and that being a reveal. The bigger picture is all disabled people have agency.
Yeah.
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 So that's like the series three kind of exploration, yes, of the idea. We've done this. And yeah, now you need to kind of be able to,
yeah, open it up and, yeah, go, right, you've heard from me. You think you know me. You care about how I'm being treated because I'm Rosie, like, you know me. So it's then how to go, disabled people isn't a concept, it's all individual pieces, and I can only tell you about me, but let's open it up to everyone.
Great. Okay, gotcha. So coming back to, I just want to come back to the writing and the first time when you mentioned the application of a judiciously chosen swear word at exactly, yes, the right time and the fact of carefully written jokes. Now, you are, I think, you're certainly unique in the history of this podcast in that when I said, have you got some stuff I can watch, even crappy preview quality, yeah, audio, whatever, you said, I can do better than that. I can send you the full transcripts of both of the shows. I was like, come on, baby. I'm absolutely loving this episode. I love Rosie so much. She is so, so funny. And I'm as guilty as anyone of falling into that idea of, because she looks sweet and behaves like such a sweet little Enid Blyton girl, certainly in the sort of early part of her career, and we'll talk about how that changes. But I'm as guilty as anyone of underestimating her, and to be constantly, mid-conversation with her, to be constantly reminded, not just this enormous joie de vivre that she has, but also just to be reminded that inside this demure girl is just a monster. So I quote her opening line to people all the time. We all hear it on this show, so I won't further butcher it now. But let's get back to Rosie in just a second. Comedianscomedian.com/insiders to get the extra content. And genuinely, if you have aspirations to one day appear on a TV panel show, you are going to need to hear what she says about the edit and making it work for you and some other stuff as well. We'll get more nerdy detail on the precision timing. And there's some listener questions, including her answer to why is Nish Kumar such a horrible man? So all of that's on the insiders. It's glistening stuff. I'm also thrilled to tell you, the next two episodes are going to be bangers as well. We've got Piff the Magic Dragon live from Las Vegas at something like 4 o'clock in the morning. Bless him. And that is, again, an astonishingly in-depth. He's best mates with Penn and Teller now. He's mates with them. And it's great hearing his role in the room when they get together and work on magic together. We're going to talk about his journey from the Edinburgh. No one says the word journey at any point. We're going to talk about what happened in his life in chronological order from, you might remember seeing him in the dragon suit schlepping around the Edinburgh Festival handing out flyers. Well, now he's in his own theatre in Las Vegas performing six nights a week the entire time. It's just a phenomenal episode. And if you're fans of Horrible Histories or You're Dead to Me, the fabulous podcast on which I've guested frequently to enormous joy on my part at least, Greg Jenner the host and powerhouse behind that, had another hugely long wall-to-wall gold interview a couple of days ago. So I think Greg's coming out next week, Piff the week after that, and there is a lot of sort of deeply personal stuff that comes out of Greg that he's never spoken about before, and you are just going to love it. So keep it com-com. That's a thing I should have been saying for 8 years. Should I? Is it awful? It's kind of awful, isn't it? But do keep it com-com anyway. That's everything. Oh, and a further thing, if you are in the Insiders Club, you know we've been doing these Insiders-only Zoom Q&As. I know that I've got all your email addresses, but I know not everybody checks their email, but if you are listening to this, if you're in the Insiders Club, we've got the Nish Kumar, James Acaster, and Alfie Brown ones now up and running, so you can listen to the audio from those ones. You can participate in the Fern Brady one that is coming up on the 24th of May, and we're also doing a Self-Help for Comedians special episode with Amanda Donnick. That's on the 7th of June. Amanda is a good friend of mine who I've never met, and we are writing a book together, and I'm going to facilitate a conversation where you get to ask a properly qualified clinical psychologist all of your questions about strategies to cope with any aspect of comedy or public, of performing or writing comedy, reviews, self-criticism, criticism from other people, managing your nerves, managing how much you reveal of your true self, any questions like that. If you're in the Insiders Club, you'll be getting an invite to that shortly. So watch your email like a hawk. That's all. Let's get back to Rosie Jones. So those, do you remember the first time you swore on stage? Or did that come with your very first gig where you wrote, I think this will work, I've got this idea for a thing, I'll write it, learn it, and try it. So at what point did the beast arise?
I think I was born with the beast inside of me. I don't think I sweared on my first set. I reckon it was one of the earliest jokes I wrote, which is the worst thing about having cerebral palsy is how long it takes me to say cerebral palsy. Blind. Deaf. Why do they get one syllable? But us lot, the slow talkers, we get five fucking syllables. I reckon that's when I first said they were fucking. And I remember it was specifically chosen because I thought it was funny that I would waste two more syllables on fucking, and it's me going, and now it'll take longer, but I am so angry right now about how slow I talk and gonna spend even more time fucking swearing.
It's that joke isn't the same joke without the word fucking. I mean, it is a very functional joke. It totally works. It would absolutely get laughed. Did you ever deliver it without the word fucking? Did you ever write it without it and deliver it with that? Because that kind of unlocks the whole thing of like, there are so many, it's not that there are so many levels. There are a few levels to it, but the level of exactly as you say, the use of the word fucking and the fact it uses up syllables in a joke about syllables is really representative of just how densely written your stuff is.
Yeah. I really like doing stand up for kids, and I I do that joke and I say five bloody syllables. So, fucking is a perfect word. But it still works for kids with bloody, but if I got a choice, always fucking.
The other thing that comes up there as well is the timing. You clearly, like, with the specific writing, there's very, very specific timing. And I don't think I've ever had anyone on the podcast before when reprising a bit of material. Oh, in fact, the only other time it came up with Marcus Birdman, and we were talking specifically about rhythm because he's a drummer and he's really interested. I don't know if he is a drummer, but I think he is a drummer, but he's interested in very, very precise rhythm, and it's said exactly the same way every time. Mm. And so to have yourself repeat that line, perform that line, with precisely the right timing, because obviously timing is critically important to what you do. And we had a listener question which puts it rather well. Louise Lee says, I'm also interested in this. Given we have so much time to anticipate a punchline, how does she find the unexpected so that we're still astonished and barking? Like, how many iterations do jokes go through before they get that good? That's as good a place to start as any other with the timing, because how many iterations do they go through? How do you find the timing, or do you hear the timing in your head as you're writing it and go, that's the one that'll work?
Oh, I think it's a different depending on the joke. I do not play any instrument, but I come from a musical family. Like, my dad's a music teacher, my brother is an amazing pianist, and a lot of my timing and a lot of my pauses, I feel them, like, and it feels like music, and I can't explain when or why, but often when I do a joke for the first time on stage, I get the pauses and the rhythm quite spot on, actually. And I think that comes from a musicality in my writing. And of course, one of my heroes is Victoria Wood. And I think her writing and her wording sounded like a song, even when it wasn't a song. So I definitely picked up on her and gone, right, that word will sound better slower, or it'll sound better in my accent. But yet, like I said, I write all of my sets and all of my shows down as a script, and then I literally go through it with a red pen and I go, will that joke still work without that word or even that syllable? Like, should I say fantastic? Or should I say great? Always great, because if I say fantastic, the audience know what I'm going to say before I've said it. So I think I got lost in my answer. But yeah, basically, when I write new material, I think I pretty much know where the process will go, unless I just have a ripper of a gig and I might go, oh, should I pause for 2 seconds longer? And sometimes it's then that I go, yeah, that works better. But I'd say 80% of the time, I pretty much write it and it pays off.
And do you think, you touched on it there, but were you meaning when you say fantastic, if you start saying the word fan, everyone else will know where it's going?
Yeah.
And it's kind of not wasted, but there's an opportunity to wrong foot, or there's an opportunity to do it more efficiently so that they don't have to be waiting. Because there is a certain amount of waiting in an audience that we go, okay, we'll get to the end of this sentence, and you need to make sure that the payoff, and you do make sure that the payoff is always worth the wait.
Yeah. It's I'm trying to think of a good example. I'll do a different one, and this is not funny, but I could say, my dad is called Rob, and I think he is terrible. Or I could say, my dad is called Rob, and I think he is shit. And I mean, that's a bad example, because shit is funnier because it's a swear word. But the audience thinks, oh, she's gonna say something lovely about her dad. And when I say shit, they're like, oh, what? Why? But if I say terrible, even on tear, they know it's not gonna be a good thing. And we're talking about split seconds here. But it just means that if I always try to get the one syllable, I've said it before they realise they've been surprised.
Yeah, right. It's a jab, not a haymaker, isn't it? Talk to me about that. You were a researcher for Objective, and was that straight off the blocks from no previous kind of creative experience or what?
Yeah. So actually, me at 30 years old, my career looks very planned and like I've nailed it. It wasn't like that at all. I went to uni and I studied English, and actually in hindsight, that is why I'm obsessed with syllables and timing, and all of that has really helped me now. But I graduated and I was a bit lost. And I was like, I literally have no interest apart from watching telly. I love telly. What's my favourite channel? Channel 4. So I just googled Channel 4 jobs and something came up called a diversity trainee scheme. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm diverse. And I applied, and I brought my mum down to London, and I was so scared, but the interview went well, and yeah, I got a job at Channel 4, but they, Channel 4 don't make shows, they buy shows from companies. So yeah, Channel 4 put me in a company called Objective, and I had loads of random archive shows. I worked on like Great Movie Mistakes and 100 most shocking moments of 2012. You know, all the Channel 5 shit shows, I worked on them. And eventually I got into panel shows. And I loved that. I worked on Would I Lie to You and 8 out of 10 Cats and The Last Leg. And I loved working with comedians. And it's kind of a weird thing in the team where it's a free-for-all. And I was on 8 out of 10 Cats. And I was like, can I write a few jokes for Jimmy Carr's opening monologue? And they were like, yeah, in your free time, if you're not paid for it. And I was like, yeah, I will. And I went away, wrote a bit, and they got picked, and Jimmy Carr said my jokes, and it was such a feeling of elation and happiness and validation immediately taken over by a feeling of jealousy, and actually I was like, this is amazing. And then I thought, he didn't pause in the right way. I just knew I could say that joke better. And that's not arrogance. That is just because I wrote it for me. So hearing Jimmy say it, I was like, oh, it's not perfect. So then I basically didn't sleep for about 3 years. I just carried my job in telly and studio shows, but every night I would go and do random gigs and be writing my own stand-up. And yeah, you're right, I think my past in production has really helped me in terms of I knew how telly works, I knew what they were looking for in terms of new comedians, and knew how to write proper panel show jokes. So, yeah, 10 years after I randomly googled Channel 4 job, it's to go from Channel 4 job to having Channel 4 primetime travel show in 10 years. That's all right, but I feel like I had 5 or 6 years in the wilderness going, well, this is a lovely life.
A mere 5 or 6 years in the wilderness. Yeah. So would you say that you have a particularly optimistic mindset, or are there particular things you think or ways you frame stuff? Is there like any kind of mantra you have, or a, not even a mantra, but just an approach you have that retains your optimism? In panel shows, in life, in writing, writer's block, anything.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it a million times, but I don't know if it's arrogance or I don't know if it's confidence, but I know in me that I am funny. But not only that, I know within me that I am a hard worker. So I have the confidence to know that my comic ability plus hard work plus time writing plus practice means that I never go into a show or a panel show or a radio show drowning. Like, if we're in, maybe I take that analogy, I am confident that I am a good swimmer. You can throw me in any pool and I won't drown. You can even throw me in the middle of the sea and I am confident enough to swim to a boat. This is also funny because in real life I can't swim. So I don't know why I went with that analogy. But you know what I mean. You could throw me in the sea and I will go, right, I don't know where I am, but and confident enough.
Totally. You have that confidence now because you have the experience now and the ability now. Did you have that confidence at the beginning of your career? Because I feel like you probably did, but it wasn't based so much on experience as some sort of inherent self-belief.
Yeah, and I thought this would come up. And that's interesting because actually this podcast is part of my journey and my confidence in that when I was a researcher going into the studio, I hadn't performed stand-up comedy at all. I hadn't written a single joke for myself. And I remember listening and going, I'm going to be on that podcast. And it wasn't like, oh, I hope one day. It was like, well, it's inevitable that as a successful stand-up comedian, I will be on that podcast. And yeah, that, call it confidence or arrogance, I remember another conversation with a friend. They said to me, you should try stand-up. And I went, oh, not yet. And they went, what do you mean, not yet? And I said, I want another year just chilling out before I get famous. Luckily for me, it's paid off. But there was just always something in me. And I think that was the fact that I knew comedy and how to write jokes. And you had the confidence and the love of being on stage. But as well as that, I knew we were approaching a time where diversity mattered. And on the panel shows I worked on, at the time, I would see the same faces, I'd see the same white, straight guys. And so me going, oh, I don't want to be famous yet, is so arrogant and so flippant. But I knew that the comedy world and TV needed a different voice, a different good voice, and I was confident enough to go, on my terms, when I'm ready, that'll be me.
I want to know what that's about. Like, where does that... Were you just born with that confidence? Or was it hard won? Or was it a thing an old man in a robe said to you when you were a kid? Do you know what I mean? Where did, like, how can you share that? Can you share the basis of that?
Yeah, I do think it is. So first, it's my mum and dad. It's the jeans. It's a fact I got my mum's comic ability and my dad's confidence and just work ethic. So, good jeans, number one. And then secondly, they were parents who just let me know that I could be anything I wanted to be, and they gave me the confidence to try out things that I probably wouldn't have without their backing. But then I do think it comes to disability. It's a fact that at 4 years old, when I started school, like, I had to do a talk in front of the class, and I had to be like, "Hello, I'm Rosie, I got cerebral palsy, I got calipers on my legs, but they don't hurt me." Maybe that was like my first stand-up routine. So I just, from the age of four, I've always walked into a room, and because of my disability, people are already looking at me. So I feel like it's a survival instinct to go, well, if they're looking at me, I'll make them look at me. Like, everyone liked me because I was a cute disabled girl. But actually, I found that if I told a joke, I would surprise them and they'd be knocked off their feet. And I love that. I love, even in my real life, I love just surprising people and making them be like, "Oh God, oh, she talks slow," but there's absolutely nothing wrong with her. So I guess before I started stand-up, I was 26. So I had 26 years of just surprising people and using comedy to get what I want. That I just had the confidence to go, I can do this on a big scale.
What kind of percentage is it whereby people constantly underestimating you partly pisses you off and partly it's an opportunity and there's power in it because you can pull the rug all the time?
It doesn't piss me off. It does not piss me off. 0%. Not at all, because when somebody underestimates me, it's a challenge and it's a fork in the road. If I win the challenge and I change their judgment on me. I have basically won over on them, and they go, yeah, don't underestimate me. And while you're at it, don't underestimate anybody, or I can't change their views. They still patronise me or ignore me or talk down to me. And if it's that road, I go, brilliant. Thank you for letting me know that you are a twat. Goodbye. So nothing pisses me off because I've either proved someone wrong or I got a bell end out of my life.
So that was Rosie. I want to listen to it again and eat it all up. What a joyous conversation. Huge, huge fan of her work. Huge fan of her as a person. And very excited to hear that she is hosting the Paralympics, which I don't believe is public knowledge. Certainly the time of recording this. I think we've got 24 more hours before this goes out from time of recording right now, in which we hope for that to be an exclusive, sexy thing. I don't know how to do press releases or anything like that, but I feel like it's quite big news. Certainly, I am that much more invested in the Paralympics now that Rosie Jones is going to be hosting. Glorious. You can find her all over the fucking internet. You don't need me to tell you where to find the brilliant Rosie Jones. She's all over YouTube. She's got a website. You can find it with a minute's Google. It'll be in the show notes to this as well, I'm sure. Her podcast is called, I'm going to say it's called Daddy Look At Me. I think it is. It's with Helen Bauer, who we spoke about on the show. If that bit didn't end up in, maybe that bit ended up in the extras. Helen Bauer's a monster as well. She'll be on before you know it. And look out for them both. Check out her podcast. Rosie's up to everything. See her on the Paralympics coverage. And watch her doing stuff. This has fallen apart now because I've been so effusive in my praise. I've got other stuff to get on with. But remember, Fern Brady and Amanda Donnett are both coming up for Insiders Only Zoom Q&As. So join the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders to support the show and get access to all of the extras. There are hundreds and hundreds of episodes of extra content. And the ones from this episode, 40 minutes, chock full of stuff, including Rosie's genuinely unmissable thoughts, strategies, insights, really, on how to make the most out of being on a TV panel show in the room and how to the sort of the pitfalls people often fall into. She talks us through some solutions to those. Ah, fabulous. Thank you to everyone. Thanks to Rosie. Thanks to Nathan Wood for producing. The music was Rob Smouten. Jake Crossland did the logging. Your podcast consultant steadfastly remains Peter Dobbing. I've been Stuart Goldsmith. You can get in touch with me, info@comedianscomedian.com or on social media @ComComPod. And if you're on LinkedIn, I'm Stuart Goldsmith, brackets Comedy Insights. And I'm doing a 30 days of resilience thing there. It's a series of resilience tips gleaned from interviews with comics. So have a suss of that if you're a business LinkedIn type person. I have a tremendous amount to offer you these days. Isn't it fun building a thing? Well, the thing's built, so come and buy the thing. That's all of that. I'll post-amble at you incredibly briefly in just a second. Back next week with Greg Jenner and then Piff the Magic Dragon and other people besides. Speak soon. Oh, what an episode. What an episode. I genuinely was so... She's just effervescent and I love... There is a thing I do where I take praise for the podcast out of the podcast because I'm too British to sit there and broadcast people telling me that the thing's important to them. And just over the last few times it's come up, I've started to leave them in and I'm thrilled to leave it in with some of it in, some of what Rosie said, because I continue to be so... deeply honoured. There's no other word for it that comics listen to this show coming up and dream of one day being on it and then can be on it. And then as it moved, God, here we go. This is a post-amble time. It's mad, isn't it? Isn't it mad? Isn't it absolutely mad? But the great thing for all the Sindhu Vs, the Ishan Akbars, the Rosie Jones, people who consider themselves students of this podcast who have gone on to such phenomenal things. And loads of, I mean, I stopped counting. There was about 200 names on a list at one point of people who felt the podcast had actually nudged them into starting doing stand-up in the first place. I don't know what I've done with it. It'll be somewhere in the cloud. But it is, I'm so proud of you. And this is the point. If you're listening to this now, look how possible it is. Look how possible it is that you be listening to this on a tube, on a train, on a bus somewhere, whilst walking your dog or doing press-ups in the snow. I don't know what you're up to. And you can be listening to this thinking, I could do it, I could do it. And some people listened to this and thought, I could do it, and they did. So maybe you can too. So why don't you believe in yourself, you idiot? Yeah, that'll do. I'm busy. Leave me alone. Bye for now. This Greg Jenner one's amazing. The Piff one's incredible too. And I think that's why I have such a spring in my step, which is just as well, because I'm about to spend the next hour learning a project time management tool called Asana. My life rocks.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.